The Hard Shoulder.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range. Celebrating 100 years of passion for the road. Recharge your soul.
Recent protests in City West and the suspected arson attack in an IPAS centre in Drogheda, it really calls into question our approach to tackling violent protests. While there is often a very heavy and very necessary focus on how they are policed, does there need to be a shift to identifying what draws people to extreme protests? Well, joining me now to discuss this is Ciara Murphy. She's the Senior Policy Officer with the ESRI, who had a piece on this in the Irish Independent only recently. And we do, obviously, our instinct when we see protests like that at City West or like in the Dublin riots is to just look at how it's policed, how it's brought under control. Do the police need more support? But you say, you know, in the aftermath, it's time to ask a bigger question, which is why? Why are citizens, our fellow citizens, drawn to protest in that particular way, in that violent way?
Yeah, absolutely. So I suppose this is kind of outside my ESRI work. I used to work in preventing violent extremism in Geneva. And so I was kind of drawing on that for the piece, because really what's happened internationally is initially it tends to be that when there are violent extremist movements, which, you know, globally have happened in a lot of different countries, people start out with a policing response, right? So the very obvious thing is you address it head on. You harden targets, so you increase security, and you go through the courts. So you target the individuals. But what most countries have realized, and what most kind of, you know, trying to tackle different movements have realized, is that that doesn't actually work very well. So often it kind of, you know, contributes to the narrative that communities are being targeted, or it just keeps popping up in different ways, because actually violent extremism is a social phenomenon often. And it really depends on the types of violent extremism. Sometimes they're just kind of one-off movements with a really charismatic leader, and then a counter-terrorism approach absolutely works. But where it is kind of a response to legitimate grievances that people don't feel that they have other ways to express, where it is an expression of a lack of self-esteem that people are getting through these movements, where it is an expression of kind of, divisions in society that are not being healed at their roots, then this other approach is needed, where you really look at the root causes, you try to understand the root causes and tackle it at the root.
So in some ways, there are parallels, I think, in what you're saying in terms of looking at why violent protests take place and why ordinary protests are taking place.
Yeah, so I suppose the difference with violent protests is that it is the method and often the level of belief in it. So extremism is kind of, you know, you believe something so much that you are willing to commit violence for it. And that's almost like a different, there are different factors involved than just normal protests. So yes, where people maybe feel that normal protests won't work or that their voice doesn't count in politics. So kind of the attitudes to immigration research finds that if you feel that your voice doesn't count in politics, that you are more likely to be negative towards immigration, for example.
And that's, I suppose, maybe the parallel maybe that I'm drawing between violent protests and non-violent protests is a lot of time people feeling that their voice isn't heard unless they resort to that particular action.
Yes, yeah. So I suppose protests can be a legitimate way of getting your voice heard as well. But I suppose kind of what I pointed out here is that your social institutions really, really matter. So protests can't be the only way that people can kind of are engaging in society, especially if, you know, whatever. So what I talked about was things that were cut during austerity, for example, like the community development program, which really focused on empowerment in marginalized community, the Combat Poverty Agency, which supported that kind of research and those movements. But also things like the National Consultative Committee on Racism and Interculturalism. I can't remember. It's a very wordy name, which was also cut during the crash and never restored, even though it was kind of preventing a lot of these problems from becoming big problems, kind of going and talking to communities and dealing with issues kind of as they arose. So again, these types of social institutions, youth work, which is still below its 2008 funding levels, even though society is much more complicated now and the population is larger, all of these things are really, you can look at and see as potential vulnerability factors in communities and root causes that we could be, and I think be looking at as well.
And should be looking at. You say a lot of the research that has looked at why people get involved in this sort of violent extremism looks at three ends. There's three ends that are needed for somebody to engage in it. Need, narrative and network. So explain those and tell us why we're looking at the narrative and network perhaps more than looking at the needs.
Yeah, so I suppose, you know, people tend to look at these things and take the most obvious parts of it, right? So often what we see is we see these narratives espoused, especially on social media, and we see the kind of network element of it as well. So people following different groups, and, you know, obviously that used to be much more literal. It used to be your actual literal social network, and now it's kind of become more, but it is your social network too. So, you know, there's findings like disadvantaged, you know, living in a disadvantaged community makes you more likely to be negative towards immigration. Now, that does not mean you are more likely to commit violent protests, but there are kind of network and social elements to this as well. So they, I think, are much easier and more obvious to understand, right? We see these narratives going on social media and we say, okay, that's what's happening. But what the preventing research really looked at is, why do some people see those and go and get in a bus and engage in a protest and you know, throw bricks at police? And why do others go, oh my God, that's nonsense? So it's, and that's where the need comes in. So there is usually some kind of need that it is addressing. And that's things like those legitimate grievances that they feel do not have avenues to be kind of addressed through a legitimate way. So there's anger there. Another is these kind of, they talk about sense of purpose. So the sense of self-esteem, a lack of sense of belonging that they're getting from this. So, you know, you can talk about economic issues there, but you can also talk about personal issues like trauma, like mental health work, youth work. So kind of, you know, and a lack of those empowerment programs, which would have been much better funded before the 2008 crash than they are now. And again, kind of, I think I mentioned that a lot of the funding is now going into diversion. So kind of, you know, when someone is already engaged in antisocial behaviour, rather than empowerment of kind of people from young ages to kind of really realise their potential.
So what does that actually look like, that empowerment piece, in a very practical way?
It really depends, because you can talk about individual empowerment and you can talk about community empowerment. So on an individual level, and really we don't know what the exact mix of factors. So each place you looked at, you know, I used to work in Somalia, Mali, Nigeria, and the mix of factors was kind of different in all of those places, right? So it depended on the context. So we don't really know, because we haven't really kind of got, you know, a really good research on this in Ireland. There's probably a mixture of individual and community level factors. And that's what we found kind of in the ESRI when we looked at attitudes towards migration as well, is that you can see individual level factors, like your level of education makes you more negative towards, so higher education, more positive. If you feel that your life was better in the past, you're more negative. So those kind of things are individual. But on a community level then too, I mentioned the disadvantage. So then the empowerment work at an individual level can look like really good youth work. So I don't know if you've, you know, if you've engaged with people who are working on youth work, especially in marginalised communities, they do really impressive work to really kind of work very closely one-on-one with kids to boost their self-esteem, to get them to realise their own potential, to support them through education, to support them into employment. So that's kind of the individual pathways, but also to support them in like political advocacy and to kind of engage in the political process. And then on the community level, it can look like social cohesion initiatives, contact initiatives between migrants and other groups. But also the community development programme would have focused a lot on helping communities to identify their own issues and give that a voice on kind of the national level or the local level to local government. So places where that can actually really be heard.
And you talk about that contact element. Mm-hmm. Bring us through what contact theory actually is. And sure. Do you think people would be willing to engage in that?
Yeah, so contact theory, and you know, there's lots of different theories that explain attitudes to immigration, but contact theory basically says that positive structured contact with immigrant groups really can improve attitudes towards immigration. So kind of having a migrant as a friend or a family member makes it much more likely that you are more positive towards immigration. It's not the only thing. So also things like, you know, like I said, feeling that your voice counts, feeling that your life was better in the past, etc., really matters. But contact theory says that, yeah, if you can bring people together in this kind of structured, positive way, not all contact actually leads to positive outcomes. Some contact leads to more negative outcomes if it's negative contact. So kind of creating these spaces can absolutely. And I think, you know, whether people are willing to engage, I think in most people's experience, they do tend to be very willing to engage. These programs are happening across the country. They're happening in family resource centres. They are happening. There are local authority integration teams now in every single local authority who tend to be working on issues like this. There's a new kind of, you know, they're happening in local development companies. People who are identifying the need for this on a local level. And not all of those have to be focused on migrant communities are bringing people together. They can be focused on other things, but kind of have both. And that tends to be where real positive contact happens. So kind of having a a women's group or a parenting group or, you know, creche and meeting people in those ways.
And yet we've seen protests at Coolock. We saw the Dublin raids. We saw what happened at City West a couple of weeks ago. To go back to that piece that you said about people having issues with self-esteem, having grievances, having the sense that their voice doesn't count. So this is the need piece that you're talking about. Why? What is it about their experience or their upbringing that leaves them feeling like that in the first place?
So that really depends. And I mean, there's an enormous literature on that. Things like adverse childhood experiences might matter. Again, kind of the link between trauma things and mental health and what leads to a lack of self-esteem is not super clear. What we know is that a lack of self-esteem, a lack of sense of belonging can create massive vulnerabilities. So, but things like inequality, so kind of we look and we see high levels of spatial inequality in a lot of areas of Dublin. So kind of people who are from very poor backgrounds living beside people who are very wealthy as well. So that can create kind of senses of self-esteem, I think is my sense. But then things like trauma, things like adverse childhood experiences, which some research has found are higher in Ireland, for example, than in other countries. So that's things like having parents who went to prison, you know, experiencing domestic violence in the home, alcoholism, addiction. And there are, you know, there are some areas where those things are quite common.
Do you think there's an appetite out there, Ciara, amongst the general public to ask the questions that you're asking here and to put the money and the support and the services in place that you say are so necessary?
I don't know. I would hope so, because I think everyone benefits when society has more social cohesion. I think everyone benefits from more empowered communities. I think everyone benefits when you don't have a very marginalised, angry group in society. And everyone benefits when young people get to grow up to, you know, to be productive citizens, to be politicians, to be, entrepreneurs, instead of ending up in prison and ending up in a cycle of violence and addiction. So I would hope so. I don't know what the answer to that is. I don't have any research to answer it.
All right. Ciara Murphy, thank you so much for coming into us here in The Hard Shoulder.
The Hard Shoulder.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range. Celebrating 100 years of passion for the road. Recharge your soul.